they got was that initial revelation, the message first of all to Mary and then to Joseph, and then the shepherds are the only corroboration that the plan is still going in the direction that it's meant to be going. Lots of prophecy has been fulfilled. The Messiah has been born in Bethlehem. We knew that. The religious leaders of the day, it tells us in Matthew 2, they knew that. But there are other prophecies still to be fulfilled. And one of those is Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, which is, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." How is that to come true? And then, of course, we know that Jesus will be from Nazareth as well. You may have seen in the past, I'm sure you probably will, in the life of the congregation, the various teachings that you've had, that Jesus, when he starts his ministry, builds effectively a new kingdom of Israel, a spiritual one. And in doing that, his life is going to mirror much of the Old Testament Israel life. So Old Testament, there were 12 tribes of Israel, and Jesus is going to call 12 disciples. In the Old Testament, they spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness as God's people. Jesus is going to spend 40 days wandering in the desert being tested. But a time of exile in Egypt is also a part of that picture. And how is that going to happen? How is God going to bring that prophecy to fulfillment? And the answer to that question comes through the wise men. More than just an addendum to the Christmas story about bringing gifts that point to who the Saviour is or tell us that his death is going to be significant. And they are in many ways something of a mixed blessing, because it would be their gifts that would provide this young family with the means for their flight to Egypt. They would need money to do that, and they're given a gift of gold. It would probably provide for them at least some of the time while they're in Egypt. But the wise men themselves were unwittingly, unintentionally, the catalyst for making that flight necessary. Because it was their arrival, it's their involvement in the whole story that leads to Herod taking an interest in the whole thing in the first place. If the wise men hadn't come, then the slaughter of the children wouldn't have taken place. And that's something I'm fairly sure they would have been devastated about if they were ever made aware of it. So who were they? When it comes to thinking about them, we're not entirely in the dark. We can make some educated guesses. Some of them are a little bit of speculation, and that's, I think, all right, as long as we're aware that that's what we're doing. As with so many participants in the gospel narratives, these men, the wise men. I'm from Glasgow, they're called them wise guys. Widows, that would be another word that we would maybe substitute for that. But they're outsiders, different kind of outsiders from the shepherds, but they wouldn't belong in the story if you were making it up in a Jewish context. You wouldn't make these people up and add them into the story. They come from the East. We know that they are astrologers of one sort or another, probably coming from Persia, and Persia was formerly Babylon. Now, in the genealogy we looked at a couple of weeks ago, one of the defining points between the 14 generations was the exile in Babylon. The Israelites had spent 7 decades under the rule of Babylon, and a lot of them had been exiled there. One of those who was exiled to Babylon was a young man called Daniel, and that's the book of Daniel. We know the story of Daniel and the lion's den, that kind of thing. And we know from the book of Daniel and his time spent in Babylon that there were people there who could read the stars. So these wise men were not unique in the world. There were places where that sort of thing was admired and respected and all the rest of it. But they were unique in Israel, because to discern things by looking at the stars was a practice clearly, unequivocally outlawed by God. Not because, I know a lot of people who will read their horoscopes and they'll read it saying, "I know it's a lot of rubbish." It's not outlawed by God because it says it's all nonsense. It's outlawed by God because he said it's dangerous. And those people will still do things. They'll maybe read something in a horoscope that says, I don't know, today is a good day, you might come into money. Right? And on the basis of that, even though they say it's all nonsense, they'll go out and buy a lottery ticket. So it changes their behaviour, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. But either way, it was outlawed, so these men were doing something that was not the norm for the people of Israel. What revelation, therefore, did they receive? A star. Perhaps they knew a little more than that. After all, Daniel was a man to whom God had revealed a great deal of knowledge about what God was going to do for many years and centuries hence. And we know that there had been a prevailing belief in the East that a great king was going to arise in Israel, and that that belief was based upon ancient prophecies that they had in that Near East. So these wise men may have had a little more than just the star, but the star is the trigger. That's what makes them get up, pack up, and head off west. And they go to the palace, and of course Jesus is not at the palace, and eventually they come and they find him not at a stable. This is a little bit further on from that. Just to preempt this, when you tell people that the wise men weren't there at the time of Jesus' birth, a lot of people come and they say things like, "You've ruined Christmas for me. You know, I have to go and alter my nativity or whatever." The reason we know that they definitely were not there at the birth of Jesus, apart from the fact that they go to a house and not a stable, is that when Jesus is taken to the temple at 40 days old, Mary and Joseph make the sacrifice of a pair of turtle doves. If they had had any means at all, such as gold, frankincense and myrrh, with any kind of financial means, they certainly would have sacrificed a lamb. So we know that they weren't there at least during the first 40 days. Herod, talking to them, he decides he wants to get every child under 2 years old. So it's possibly a little bit later. I'm really sorry if that detracts from something that you've always believed. But they're not there in the first day. They find Jesus, though, nevertheless, in quite humble surroundings. But they're not put off by that. There's no suggestion that they turn up and they find this young baby in a fairly humble family and somehow think that they've got it wrong, that they've got the wrong place. And that may have come from the prophecies that they had from the days of Daniel. So the people of Israel had been in Babylon as exiles 600 years before. Now during that time, lots of prophets had spoke. So Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Joel, Habakkuk. But Daniel had made some very specific prophecies about the kings and the kingdoms of the future. Wouldn't it be ironic to think that while Israel in that intervening 600 year period has grown indifferent to the promise of the Messiah, that Israel is not excited by it anymore, it's not watching and waiting for it anymore, but while Israel grows cold, that someone far, far away, hundreds of miles away, has been waiting more actively for the day when this king would come. That these men have been watching, that their ancestors, presumably their descendants of others who have been watching in these intervening six centuries since Israel was in Babylon, for hundreds of years, while Israel had said they've been praying for this child to come, when God answers their prayers, Israel is not ready. Israel doesn't believe it. They've stopped watching. They've turned off their eyes for the answer to God's prayers. There were rabbis in Israel who had started teaching people that the Messiah is a figurative concept. We're not waiting for an individual person. God never intended for a real person to come. That's what they were teaching. And they were trying to explain away because it was getting a little bit awkward. There had been hundreds of years. There was no word from God. There were no new prophets for hundreds of years. There was no sign of the Messiah arriving. They had given up. Do you know, I criticize them. But we can be a bit like that. There had been nothing from God for around 400 years by this point. Between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, 400 year gap. And they had just decided, well, clearly it's not happening. But it would be wrong to assume that God had been inactive during a 400 year period. What had God been doing? Well, amongst other things, God had raised up for his own purposes the Roman Empire. The Romans arrived on the scene, they built a vast network of good quality straight roads. It made travel much easier. They also have made journeying much safer from the bandits and the raiders that used to rule the roads in the ancient Near East and across, as it spread across Europe. Under the Romans, you could go to sea for the first time and know that you would not be taken by pirates, thanks to the Roman Empire. The rise of the Roman Empire also meant that there was now a Jewish synagogue in every town with scriptures there and with somebody who could read and explain those scriptures. So under the Roman Empire, it all came together at the right time. So when the Son of God appears in the world stage in Israel, when he lived and died and rose again, the news could travel everywhere in the known world, and it could travel quickly and safely. That networks of Christians, as they appeared in the various towns and cities and countries across the world, they could keep in contact, they could get teaching, they could get correspondence, the letters of Paul could reach these people. And then after Constantine in 312 AD, won the Battle of Malvern Bridge, after praying to the God of Christians for help, overnight Christianity becomes the official state religion of the whole empire, from Spain to India and all across North Africa. And having done its job, the Roman Empire is dispensed with. And it just dissolves, it breaks up in the 4th century. That was all in the lead up to the events in Matthew, at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, the beginning of the New Testament. So God was preparing the ground. He hadn't sent prophets. They weren't getting that word of God in the sense that they had been up until that point. But God had prepared the ground, even in what looked like oppression by a foreign power. God was working, but they didn't see it. And when God answered their prayers, they hadn't been watching and they didn't believe it. In fact, it's probably the opposite. I'm sure many of these people saw the Roman Empire as a sign of the absence of God. And you see that in the scriptures itself. In Zechariah, Luke chapter 1, maybe one Christmas we'll get to it, but we probably will get to Luke chapter 1. When the angel goes to Zechariah and Gabriel, and he says to him, I'm here, I've come to you from the very presence of God to tell you that your prayers have been answered and you don't believe it. You don't believe it. God's always working out his purposes. He is never inactive. And his word has been working away for centuries in a place where no one thought it was. And it has borne fruit over 500 years after it was planted. Not a mature faith or anything, but a tangible result that has filled these men with a faith, with a love, that coming to seek Jesus, and nothing is going to stop them. Actually, if you been there when they were coming, these would have been prime candidates to give an Alpha Course card to, because that's what they needed. But the initial movement is there, put there by the Spirit of God. Now, that has to give us encouragement, doesn't it, for our witness as a church, for our efforts as individuals in schools, universities, colleges, workplaces, all of these environments, that the word shared with others long ago might one day result in them or even their descendants seeking Jesus with a heart determined to find him. So shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose. It shall succeed in the thing for which I sent it. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 11. And it's astonishing to think, not just that the word was working away there, but the exile in Babylon, with all of its associated pain and trauma and the catastrophes of warfare and invasion, all that goes with that, packaged up, you know the kind of thing I'm talking about. That all of that took place so that the seed of God's word might be planted in Babylon, in order that 600 years later, a group of men might spot a new star in the sky, and it makes sense to them. They have a framework upon which to, an incredible thought that reassures us that no witness for God is ever wasted. Back at the time when they were suffering, nobody surely could have foreseen that God was doing any of that. We may be completely blind to what God is doing. in our lives, in our village, town, in our country. You know, a lot of people ask questions after a general election, regardless of who wins or how it's... A lot of people are left with questions. We must never forget that whoever wins an election at whatever level, God is still in control. Jesus is still in charge. And he's working. We may not know what he's doing, but he is doing something. So these wise men remind us that God is always working even in unlikely places. But they also, and this is perhaps more of a warning than just a teaching point, that sometimes those closest to the truth don't see it. Those closest to the truth are the least likely to see it. Those with the most religious privilege gave Christ the least honour. Of all the people who came, the shepherds were outcast because of their job, because they worked with the animals. They weren't allowed into certain parts of the temple. They were excluded from large sections of the religious life in Israel. So they're outcasts in one sense. These men are Gentiles. They're outcasts in entirely a different sense. They have the least religious opportunity, the least religious privilege, and yet they are the ones, contrasted with Herod, contrasted with the religious people, these are the ones who pay Christ the honour. They've undoubtedly travelled a great distance. There was no public transport, no trains, no buses, no flights. I mean, it's Christmas time, so they probably would have found it difficult to get a flight anyway. But they came with... It was a wee joke. I'll pause just to let that settle down. So they've come a great distance, possibly with camels, possibly as well on foot. Certainly some of the party would have been on foot. That's a dangerous thing to do. There were plenty of bandits going to the east, plenty of bandits just waiting for an opportunity, such as these wealthy people would present. They're carrying nice things, they've got nice clothes. That's attractive to a bandit. But they would also have had to spend a long time away from their homes, from all that they knew, from all that they loved, to come on this quest. And when you consider what revelation they had been given and how small it was, you would maybe agree with one of the commentators who I love reading, a man called J.C. Ryle. He's long, long dead. But he says this story is perhaps the greatest display of faith in the whole Bible. And it's hard to disagree with that. These non-covenant foreigners who are participating in this somewhat dubious activity are the ones who come and pay Christ honour and who receive the blessing. Jesus himself said, "Blessed are those who believe without seeing." And these men did. And they're a great example of faith. They believed without seeing him. They believed even when the religious establishment told them that they were wrong. They believed when they saw him as a young child with no prospects at all in the world. They believed when they had seen no miracles to convince them. They had heard no teaching to persuade them. They had no signs at all that God was involved in this except a star. And yet it says they fell down and they worshipped him. It is tremendous faith, really. And a strange story. Our familiarity with it dents the strangeness of it. We have 1,000 times the evidence. We can go onto the internet, we can hear speakers and teachers, we can read books from all across centuries, all across the world. We have all of that. Is our faith as strong as that? Those who had it treated it with contempt. They wouldn't allow Jesus into their lives. They wouldn't let Jesus change the religious structure that they had built. They had invested so much in it. It was theirs and there was no room for Jesus to come. He came to his own and his own did not receive him. And so the blessing went to the unexpected, to the outsiders, to the Gentiles. Sometimes in the religiousness of our faith, these things can be, the right things can be squeezed out. And it is not just a good idea, it is our obligation to ensure that Jesus is always first and that the worship of him and that we like the wise men are falling down in front of him in worship is always the very highest first priority of our lives. going to move in a moment to the Lord's table. We're going to sing before we do that. Our next song is Be Still for the Presence of the Lord. The Holy One is here. Come to the Lord's table, and as we gather here, we remind ourselves that this table does not belong to any person, it does not belong to the church, it's not the congregation's table, it's not the Church of Scotland's table, it is the Lord's table. And the invitation to dine at this feast comes therefore not from me or from us, it comes from the Lord himself. And all who have believed and trusted on him for salvation are welcome to share at this feast which he provides. Word says,